Good morning.
Good morning.
Great to have you with us today. You know, as we think about the church in the United States, we can name off a whole bunch of different issues that are problematic. We can think about the declining influence of the church in our culture today. We can think about the fact that the church seems to be known more for what it stands against than what it stands for. We can think about the fact that it's losing ground with the newer generations that are coming up. Articles, why are the younger generations leaving the church? I see a lot of those out in the media today. But I want to bring up a point that I think is just as bad and maybe worse than some I've just mentioned. The fact of the matter is that the church in America today is too often simply boring. Boring. Now, what do I mean by this? Well, hopefully not that the pastor is boring. And you get the, what did I hear out there? I hear an amen on that one. It's boring, I think, because we don't see enough exciting stuff happening. It's kind of business as usual, day after day, week after week. We go through the motions. We sing the songs. You hear it. We hear the sermons. We study our Bibles, but where's the excitement? Where is the stuff going on around us that kind of grabs us? And where we have the wow? Where's the wow? Now, I'm not talking here about in worship, well, we need, you know, explosions here up on the stage now. And, you know, and smoke pots and lights that kind of go all over the place. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about something different. But I think this boring factor, quite frankly, extends even outside of the church. I think a lot of Americans today are simply just plain bored. Why do I believe this? Well, I heard at the Leadership Summit just this last week, the last Thursday and Friday, outstanding summit this year. We spend, us Americans, 3 billion hours a week on video games. $3 billion a week. What about the huge popularity of reality TV shows? They are ranking in the tops, you know, on all channels and all time slots. People are dying to see other people do crazy, stupid things. And then I don't even want to speculate on the time squandered looking at what someone else is eating posted on Facebook. Stop that stuff. All right, get rid of that slide. That's enough of that. Yeah. I think we're bored. Where's the wow? Where's the wow in our lives? Well, guess what? I think God wants to give us some wow. I think if we were truly committed and truly living out the call of Jesus Christ, there would be wow in our lives constantly. Because when you get involved in doing God's work, you're getting involved in doing God-sized stuff. When you get involved in doing God's work, you get involved in God-sized stuff. Not normal stuff, not human stuff, God-sized stuff. And wow is just a part of that. We're in this series called Intersections. And I think this is a foundational truth of this series, Intersections. Intersections, what I'm talking about here is that we're all living out our lives. We all have our plot lines for our own personal lives. We're writing our own stories, but God has a meta story. He has a big story. And his story started from before our time and will keep going right after this world and the universe is all wrapped up like a scroll. Every now and then, God comes into our little stories with his big stories. He intersects our lives and he says, I got something for you to do. I got someone for you to talk to. I've got some ministry for you to start or get involved in. I've got something for you to do. And that's when life gets exciting and life fills up with meaning and purpose and joy, which our people in our world today so desperately need. We've looked at different people's stories from the start of this. And today we're going to look at a man, a simple man named Gideon. Gideon. There was nothing uncommon about him. He was a very common folk. But his story illustrates, I think, when God invites us to do God-sized work and need to act out with a God-sized faith, and God-sized stuff happens. Now, a little background before we get into the text. It's in Judges chapter 6, if you want to turn there. We don't go to Judges very often. You might need to look it up in your table of contents. You know, where is Judges? Old Testament, start with that. Look it up in your table of contents. Judges, okay. Gideon lived in a time after the Exodus. We start with that. Moses, you know, went to the Pharaoh, "Let my people go." And they got out. God did miraculous stuff, and they got out, and they were freed from slavery. 40 years wandering in the wilderness. Then Moses dies. Joshua, his protege, takes over, and they go into the promised land, the land of Canaan, and they begin to take it piece by piece by piece from the people who were there. They didn't take out everybody, though. And that's the unfortunate thing, because as they left people there, what happened was that the people who were still there worshiping pagan gods started to affect the Israelites. And in the book of Judges, you see this very sad story. It's a cycle. It's an up and it's a down. It starts usually with the down. The people are turned to other gods to worship. Remember, Yahweh said, "Worship me and me alone. Trust me. I can handle life for you. I can take care of business. All you need to do is trust me." And the people said, "Well, okay, but we'll trust you, but if we want to get our crops watered, we need to worship Baal, who's the god of the thunderstorm and fertility. And so we need to worship him, too, to make sure it rains and to make sure the crops are fertile and the livestock get together the way they need to. And we have lots of more livestock and good crops, you know." And on that would go. "We'd worship you, Yahweh, but we've got to take care of business over here. So we're going to worship other gods." So you have this, and God says, "Okay, folks, you know what? We talked about this back in the book of Deuteronomy. Moses talked to you guys, and he said, now, you know, worship me, or I'm going to have to bring in some way of getting your act back together." And so there would be various nations that would come in and enslave and hassle and persecute and just make life miserable for the Israelites. They would finally get it. They would cry out to God. And they'd say, "Oh, we need your help, Yahweh." And God would say, "Okay, I'm here for you." And he would raise up what was called a judge, a leader. And this leader would rally the troops, and they'd fight the battle, and they would win the battle and drive out the problem. And then the people were all good. They were worshiping Yahweh and him alone. And it was good times. But then that generation would die out. New generation comes in that didn't see what had happened. The judge had died, and people started drifting again. Just drift, you know. We have drift constantly in our lives, away from God. And so more discipline, more bad times, people crying out again. We've had four of these cycles now in the book of Judges by the time we get to Gideon. Four judges have been raised up to get the people out of trouble and bring them back to God. And now we're on number five. His name's Gideon. But first, we'll see the trouble that they got into. So here we are, Judges chapter 6, starting with verse 1. "Again, the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord, and for 7 years he gave them into the hands of the Midianites. Because the power of Midian was so oppressive, the Israelites prepared shelters for themselves in mountain clefts, caves, and strongholds. Wherever the Israelites planted their crops, the Midianites, the Amalekites, and the other eastern peoples invaded the country. They camped on the land and ruined the crops all the way to Gaza." Gaza's on the Mediterranean coast. "And they did not spare a living thing for Israel, neither sheep or cattle or donkeys. They came up with their livestock and their tents like swarms of locusts. It was impossible to count the men and their camels. They invaded the land to ravage it. Midian was so impoverished the Israelites that they cried out to the Lord for help." Let me keep reading to 10 here. When the Israelites cried out to the Lord because of Midian, he sent them, now first a prophet, not a judge, but a prophet, who said, "This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. I brought you up out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. I snatched you from the power of Egypt and from the hand of all your oppressors. I drove them from before you and gave you their land. I said to you, 'I am the Lord your God. Do not worship the gods of the Amorites in whose land you live.' But you have not listened to me." Okay. Cycle one more time. The call of Gideon comes in this context. Another cycle. This time, it's the Midianites and the Amalekites, two groups of people who lived east of the Jordan River, and then this kind of a big grouping of, and the other guys. And a bunch of other guys. These people were all nomads by nature. They traveled around from place to place. And during crop time, they said, "Yay!" You know, particularly the Valley of Jezreel is kind of the breadbasket of Israel, even today. You know, Ukraine, it's a breadbasket, right? Talking to some Ukrainians here. And the fact of the matter is it's a beautiful, yeah, yay, all right. Fly the flag. Well, you know, a breadbasket. People like where they're growing good stuff. And these Midianites and Amalekites and other peoples from the east, the Arabs they're called in other translations, they come swarming in and they take everything. Well, finally, the people humble themselves. They say, "You know what? This isn't working." You ever gotten to a place in your life where you said, "This isn't working"? Like in AA, they say, you know, for you to hit bottom, you have to come up with, "I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired." You hit bottom. You say, "Enough." That's what they came up with. "Is this working?" And so, maybe we should try God. Just a thought. So they return to Yahweh and they cry out to him. And in this cycle, interestingly enough, God says, "Well, we need a little theological explanation before we go any further here. We need to remind you of why you're in this pickle and what you need to do. Remember, I was the God who got you out of Egypt, out of slavery. Remember, I was the one who led you into the promised land and gave you victory. Remember, worship me and me alone." "Right, got it, God." Now, after the theological history lesson, God comes to earth in the form of an angel, and he comes to this young man named Gideon, verse 11 through 16. "The angel of the Lord came and sat down under the oak at Ophrah that belonged to Joash the Abiezrite, where his son Gideon was threshing wheat in a wine press to keep it from the Midianites. When the angel of the Lord appeared to Gideon, he said, 'The Lord is with you, mighty warrior.' 'But sir,' Gideon replied, 'if the Lord is with us, why has all this happened to us? Where are all his wonders that our fathers told us about when they said, 'Did not the Lord bring us out of Egypt?' But now the Lord has abandoned us and put us into the hand of Midian.' The Lord turned to him and said, 'Go in the strength you have, and save Israel out of Midian's hand. Am I not sending you?' But Lord," Gideon asked, "'how can I save Israel? My clan is the weakest in Manasseh, and I am the least in my family.' The Lord answered, 'I will be with you, and you will strike down all the Midianites together.'" Some versions it says, "all the Midianites as one man." You'll just knock them down. I smiled when I read this part about Gideon's complaint back to the angel of the Lord, where he says, "Well, why is all this bad stuff happening to us?" I guess he didn't get the theological memo. You know, he wasn't on the email list. He didn't read the news where the prophet had come in and told him exactly why they were suffering like this. And again, I wonder about ourselves and how often we're crying out to God for some pickle that we've gotten ourselves into. And we blame him for it. But we don't have time to go there with that one either. So just a little sidebar. Now, if the Lord is with us, well then, why is this stuff happening? But God isn't all knocked off track by Gideon's misguided complaining. God has come to appoint a leader, a judge. So God says, go in the strength that you have and save Israel out of Midian's hand. Gideon objects. Now, if you've been following this series at all, this sounds a little familiar. God comes to somebody and says, tapping you on the shoulder, you're the man, you're the woman, want you to go out and make it happen. Oh, got the wrong guy. Got the wrong girl here. No, no, you must be thinking about somebody else. My twin brother, you know, Sidian. He's over there in another field. You want to go talk to him, right? How can I save Israel? Who am I that I should be able to do this? Now, he brings in a new wrinkle that we haven't seen before in his excuses. He says his clan, his tribe, Manasseh, is the weakest of all the 12 tribes. Not much going for us as a family, you know? And I'm the least in my family. So you got the weakest tribe, the weakest family, and I'm not so good myself. The New Living Translation says, my clan's the weakest in Manasseh, and I'm the run of the litter. I like that. Wrong guy. Need to go over and talk to Sidian. He must be the guy. But God refuses to take the bait. And what does he do? Like he does so many times, it's very exasperating. He just says, I will be with you. I will be with you. That's all he says. Now, I'd like, if I were Gideon, I would like, well, God, can I see a business plan? A Gantt chart? A PowerPoint presentation? Can I see, you know, table of organization and equipment here? Would you please map this thing out so I have an idea of where we're going with this? I will be with you. That's it? Yeah, that's it. Now we have to skip ahead. We don't have time to go into this whole story. By the way, this story, if you're into these things, there are a lot of personal stories in the book of Judges. This is the longest of all of them, which is interesting to me. The story of Gideon, this guy who didn't have a lot going for him, it's the longest story in the entire book of Judges. Beats out the story of Samson. You might have heard of Samson. You heard of Samson. It beats Samson's story out by 4 verses. So Gideon does have something going for him. You know, 4 more verses. But we can't spend time on the whole thing, so we need to move ahead. And I call this section Reduction in Force. So let's turn to chapter 7 and verse 1. A lot of stuff's happened. Good stuff. And here we go in 7:1. Early in the morning, Jerubbaal, that is Gideon, he'd gotten a nickname by now, and all his men camped at the spring of Harod. The camp of Midian was north of them in the valley near the hill of Moreh. The Lord said to Gideon, you have too many men for me to deliver Midian into their hands, in order that the Israel will not boast or may not boast against me that her own strength has saved her. Announce now to the people, anyone who trembles with fear may turn back and leave Mount Gilead. So 22,000 men left, while 10,000 remained. But the Lord said to Gideon, there's still too many men. Take them down to the water, and I will sift them for you there. I will say, you know, this one shall go for you, and this one shall go, but I'll say, this one shall not go for you, and he shall not go. So Gideon took the men down to the water. Now the Lord said to him, separate those who lap the water with their tongues like a dog from those who kneel down to drink. 300 men lapped with their hands to their mouths. All the rest got down on their knees to drink. The Lord said to Gideon, with 300 men that lapped, I will save you and give the Midians into your hands. Let all the other men go, each to his own place. So Gideon sent the rest of the Israelites to their tents, but kept the 300 who took over the provisions and trumpets of the others. Wow. Gideon blows the trumpet, gathers the armies from the surrounding tribes. 32,000 men. Hey, pretty good. 32,000 men are ready to go for God. And God says, you know what? Your problem has been throughout all of this that you keep trusting in yourself and not in me. So I'm going to set this up this time so it's very, very obvious that I'm going to pull this off, not you. It's for your own good. It's for your good because you need to know that I'm bigger than you are and that you can trust in me and my power. So we're going to have a reduction in force, Gideon. First of all, think about yourself as Gideon, all right? You're already timid. You already, you know, haven't got the best self-image. And you, oh, 32,000. Okay, I think we can do something here. And God says, too many men. Everybody who's afraid gets to leave. Oh, great. How many are afraid? So watch them go. One by one, five, tens, twenties, thirties, forties, and fifties. Thousands of them leave to where they're now down to a third, was it? A third of their original size. And then God comes back and says, oh, not enough. Got to take out a few more. Now, the way God chooses to do this, I have absolutely, you know, I have been to seminary. I have read theological books. I have a lot of theological books in my library. Come in and look at my list of books. Just watch, look at them. Be very impressed. Pastor, have you read them? No, I have not. But, but they look good. And I've read a few. I have no idea what's going on here. I'm going to separate the men out this way. If they kneel down to drink from the water and they take their hand and they put the water in their hand and they bring it up and they lap it like a dog, you keep them. But if they go all the way down and stick their head in the water, and I get rid of those guys. Now, some have speculated, oh, well, you see, he was watching. God was trying to thin it out to the people who were watching what's going on around them. They are taking the water, but their eyes are up, right? Looking around. Oh, Midianites. Let's go get them, you know. Versus the guys are sticking their head in the water, and Midianite comes up. Ah, you're dead, you know. Somebody actually wrote that. And I thought, well, okay, that's cool. I have no idea what's going on here. Except to say that God wanted to pare down this force to 300 men. Now, if you're Gideon, what are you thinking? And what are you feeling? 300 men? That's it? Ooh, that's not so good. If you're trusting in the strength of man, if you're trusting in the ability of man, well, you're pretty nervous right now if you're Gideon. Heart rate's going up. Eyes dilating. Fight or flight syndrome. But God steps in, you know, and he realizes he's got the heart monitor on Gideon. You know, he can tell what's going on inside his heart and his brain and every other part of his body. And he goes, oh, Gideon, you know, maybe you need another sign. There have been lots of signs, by the way, that we haven't taken the time to look at. But I like what he does with this one final sign. Judges 8, excuse me, 7, 8b through 15. Now the camp of Midian lay below them in the valley. During that night, the Lord said to Gideon, get up and get down against the camp because I'm going to give it to you, give it into your hands. Now, if you are afraid to attack, well, that could be since you are afraid to attack, go down to the camp with your servant, Pirah, and listen to what they are saying. Afterward, you will be encouraged to attack the camp. So he and Purah, his servant, went down to the outposts of the camp. The Midianites, the Amalekites, and all the eastern people had settled in the valley, the Jezreel Valley, thick as locusts. Their camels could be no more be counted than the sand on the seashore. Gideon arrived just as a man was telling a friend a dream. I had a dream, he was saying. A round loaf of barley bread came tumbling into the Midianite camp. It struck the tent with such force that the tent overturned and collapsed. His friend responded, "This can be nothing more than the sword of Gideon, son of Joash, the Israelite. God has given the Midianites and the whole camp into his hands." When Gideon heard the dream and its interpretation, he worshipped God. And he returned to the camp of Israel and called out, "Get up! The Lord has given the Midianite camp into your hands." Now, Gideon may be of the tribe that's not so cool, and he may be the run of the litter. But you know, with a sign like this, how can you not get it? You go down to the outposts, you're out there, the camp is spread before you, just innumerable numbers of people, camels, everything going on down there. And you're at one of the outposts, so you kind of crawl up in the brush, and you're listening to two sentries talking, and one says, "I had a vision, I had a dream, and it was this barley loaf coming down, knocking over a tent, and oh my gosh, what was that about?" And the other guy goes, "Oh, gee, we're doomed! Yahweh, their God, that's just a sign. Yahweh, their God, my gosh, to get in. You know, he's going to take us out. Woe is us." And you don't see it in the text here, but I wonder if God said, "Gideon, you get it? You know, do you get it? I'm giving you a little sign here to tell you what's going on." Now, in life today, we have lots of signs that come to us, and some of these signs can be real confusing. I just decided to, find a few confusing signs in life. And let's see, we have some like this one. Lane closed to ease congestion. Okay. One way, but it's a dead end. Good luck with that. Or the next one. I don't know what you're supposed to do when you get to this. What's next? Next one. What does that mean? We got one more, right? Hold it for a second. Bill Wright, would you stand up? Okay, somebody came across this. Who knew? I just don't know how far away you are. Are you 15 miles or 55? But, you know, it doesn't matter. What was that, Montana? Wyoming. Wyoming, Bill, you have properties. Go check it out. Sometimes life gives us confusing signs. You've seen a few. All right, get rid of Bill. But God was as clear as day with Gideon on this one. Gideon knew exactly what was going to happen. Now all he had to do was take the courage to execute it and watch God work. And that's what he does. I call it the deliverance. Chapter 7, 16 to 23. Dividing the 300 men into three companies. Now he's divided his forces. He placed trumpets and empty jars in the hands of all of them with torches inside. "Watch me," he told them. "Follow my lead. When I get to the edge of the camp, do exactly as I do. When I and all those who are with me blow our trumpets, then from all around the camp, blow yours. Blow your trumpets and shout for the Lord and for Gideon." Gideon and the 100 men with him reached the edge of the camp, and beginning at the beginning of the middle watch. That was kind of cool, right in the middle of the night, just after they had changed the guard. So these guys are sleepy, they're just waking up, they're not happy to have to, you know, take the middle of the night watch. And there they are. They blew their trumpets and broke the jars which were in their hands. The three companies blew the trumpets, smashed the jars, grasping the torches in their left hand and holding in their right hands the trumpets they were to blow. They shouted, "A sword for the Lord and for Gideon." While each man held his position around the camp, all the Midianites ran, crying out as they fled. When the 300 trumpets sounded, the Lord caused the men throughout the camp to turn on each other with their swords. The army fled to Beth Shittah toward Zeruah, as far as the border of Abel Mahola, near Tabith. Israelites from Naphtali, Asher, and all Manasseh were called out, and they pursued the Midianites. a total rout of those coming in. A total victory for the Israelites. 300 men. Well, 301, to be specific. Routed this monstrous army. Now, what are the lessons here for us? I think there are a few. I went back and looked at a book I read a while ago. It's a great book. It's very simply written. But it's by a guy, the primary author's name is Henry Blackaby. And he wrote a book called Experiencing God. And it's a bestseller. And he makes some very basic and very straightforward and yet I think very challenging statements in this book. The first one he says is something we've said here a lot, that God is at work, and he invites us to join him in the work. God invites us to join him as he is already working. He invites us to join him in what he's already doing. It's not as though we have to think up stuff. It's that God is already into stuff. God's already active and moving and accomplishing his work out in the world around us. We just need the eyes to see it. And then to hear the call of God, to respond to it, and get involved in it. God is at work in the lives of the people you know, at school, in the marketplace, in the office, at Safeway, in my chiropractic office. God is at work in the lives of these people. Jesus said, if I be lifted up, I will draw all men to myself. If you be lifted up and put on a cross, from that point on, the love of God is reaching out to people and drawing them towards himself. It's happening all around us. Do we see it? Do we perceive it? God is doing his work. He calls us to join him in his work. We saw how God commissioned Moses to go for him and free the Egyptians. God had come down. He was concerned about his people. We saw the risen Christ confront the Emmaus disciples with the reality of the resurrection and the great commission then that goes with it. We saw the Holy Spirit directed Philip to go to a desert road and meet up with a guy he'd never met before, an Ethiopian court official, and lead him to Christ. We saw how Christ challenged Paul, knocked him off his horse, to take the gospel to the Gentiles. We saw how the Holy Spirit empowered the disciples to share their faith in wondrous ways on the day of Pentecost. We've seen it and seen it and seen it, how story after story after story where God was working and he calls his people to join him in the work. God is up to something. We need to be involved. Number two, though, when God invites us to join him, it's often a God-sized work. This one kind of throws us. God doesn't do small. God does big. The conversion of a human heart is big. It's a miracle. It's a miracle any one of us receive the gospel of Jesus, because we are self-centered. We worship at the shrine of me, myself, and I. We want to live our own lives and do our own thing, and yet there are many of us here today who have bowed the knee to Jesus Christ and said, you take it, God. You run my life. You got more going than I do. I will trust my existence to you. That's a miracle. God does big. God does nebulas. God does galaxies. God does clusters of galaxies. Think about after the resurrection when Jesus said to his disciples, now 11 now, one finked out. I want you to go into all the world and preach the good news of the gospel. Make disciples of all nations. These guys hadn't even been outside of Israel. They had no idea how big the world was. They had some concept of how big the Roman Empire was. They had some idea of the opposition they were going to run into. But they had no idea the size and the scope of the commission that God was giving to them at that moment. With hindsight, we see it. They didn't have that hindsight. They are confronted with a challenge bigger than life. It's a God-sized work. And because it's a God-sized work, when God invites us to join him in the work, it creates a crisis of faith. That's the way Blackaby puts it. And rereading this book, this is what jumped out at me and hit me from the page. When God calls us to join him in a God-sized work, it's a crisis of faith. What do I really believe about God? Who is God really? Is he big enough to get this done? Is he big enough to handle this kind of challenge? Does he really know what he's doing more than what I see and what I think and what my friends tell me? How big is God? How big's your God? Here's where the boring part is. Too much church work is done not in the power of God, but in the power of you and me. I can get up here and talk at you. You can read a book and try to understand what it's saying to you. We can all go out and be nice to people. Sometimes. Right? Do we need God in any of that? It's only when you attempt to do God-sized stuff that we need God-sized resources. It requires a God-sized faith. Actually, that's not quite true. What did Jesus say about faith? How big does your faith need to be? Small as a mustard seed. That was the smallest seed that the people of Israel at the time knew about. Teeny tiny little seed. Because it's not the amount of faith that you have, it's what you place your faith in. You can have the smallest amount of faith, but do you place it in a big, big God? Because if you place your little bitty faith in a big God, big things can happen. So it's not us drumming up more faith. It's us thinking about, praying about, who are we putting our faith in? Blackaby talks about in his book, their church, which is up in Canada at the time. You know, he's been preaching all this to the people, and the people, oh, they were pretty wild people. They took him at his word. And they said, well, pastor, you know, you're talking about doing God-sized work with God-sized faith. So, what we're doing now doesn't seem to be that God-sized. And look at our budget, for instance. Our budget is based on what we think we can raise. We have an estimate given to us on what we think we can raise in terms of the people who are in the church. We can do the tables and we can do the math and we can look at the stats and we can think, I think we can raise this much money from the people in the church. And then, pastor, we also got income from other sources that come to us. We'll add those in too. Now, pastor, this is what we tend to do is we tend to look at that bottom line and say, well, that's as much ministry as we can get done this year. What if we asked it a different way? What if we asked the question, God, what do you want us to do? And ask that question first and pray about it and talk about it and pray about it some more and figure out what God is calling us to do. And we put a number on that. If this is how much it's going to take to get that done. And then we look at how much we think we can raise and how much the other sources are going to raise. And there's going to be a gap. And who's going to supply the gap? God's going to supply the gap. To do God-sized work, you need God working and God resourcing it. And that's exactly what they started doing. Now, you know, in our church, we think this way a little bit. I was looking at our budget year to date as of June. What's the amount that God has provided already entirely on his own? Well, I don't know if I've got all my figures right. The finance department will be talking to me later, I'm sure. But you know, up to the end of June, we've given, I think it's $223,000. We're over budget in our giving this year. And that's from what the people are giving and what our out income sources are giving. But do you realize we've had over and above giving from people, one person in particular who doesn't even come to this church? And so far, year to date, that kind of giving is $20,000 over what the figure I just gave us. In other words, well, we think we can raise this, and we know the income streams from antennas and, you know, and this sort of thing is that. But in addition to that, God has blessed this church with over $20,000 of giving, and we had no idea it was coming. God blesses when people are doing his work. God can pull money out of a hat. He owns all the hats. Because God loves to show forth his glory, and he loves to do a work where people go back and go, wow, that's cool. That's a theological statement, by the way. That's really cool. Look at God work. And I wonder, I look at myself and I think, how much am I restraining the work of God in this place because I don't have a big enough faith? Or my faith in God isn't very big. I wonder about that. Kind of haunts me sometimes. And I wonder about you and your life and what God is calling you to do, where he's calling you to step out and do something. You say, oh, no. I don't have the resources. I don't have the experience. I don't have the knowledge. I don't have the ability. I'm from a small family. We're not so hot, and I'm the run of the litter. You must be talking about my brother Simeon over there if you want something done. And God said, no. I'm talking to you. I'm talking to you. I believe in you, and I believe in me. God believes in himself. And so when he calls us to a God-sized work, it takes a God-sized faith, which causes a crisis on our part. Do we believe it? Do we really believe it? But here's the last thing. We finish with this. When God does a God-sized work through us, the world sees God. Blackaby says in his book, what our world often sees in the church are devoted, committed Christians serving God. But the world are not seeing God. They comment, well, there's a wonderful, dedicated, committed group of people serving God. They, however, do not see anything happening that can only be explained in terms of the activity of God. Why? Because we are not attempting anything that only God can do. Ooh. Wouldn't it be wonderful to see God working in our midst? Wouldn't it be wonderful for you to see God working in and through you in your personal life? I think that would be the opposite of boring. I think that would be exciting. I think every day becomes an adventure. What is God up to today? And how does he want to involve me in his work? Anybody here want to be bored? Don't sign up for the kingdom. The kingdom is not boring. Let's pray. Gracious Father, challenging words for me, for all of us. We're rather timid people. Even when you bless us in ways that are unmistakable, even when you do things in our midst and we say, only you could have pulled that one off. We didn't see that one coming at all. And how good it is. Even when the wow factor shows up, we're still timid. We still need more signs. Father, don't increase our faith. Help us to focus our faith. Help us to take you more seriously. Help us to see you as the one true God of this universe, not the false gods that are all around us. Help us depend on you and follow you and seek you and give our lives over to you so that we could fulfill our purpose in life to find the greatest joy in your presence and giving you glory. That's our prayer. That's what we give to you today, and we give it in the name of the one who gave up his life so that we get to do all this and much, much more. Amen.